Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up on Word of Mouth, spying in space. The American Museum of Natural History is redefining how we observe planets outside of our solar system using high-tech spectroscopy. And Peyton Place, almost 60 years later, a journalist travels to Gilmanton, New Hampshire to dig up the dirt on the lingering grudge over Grace Metalius' scandalous novel. And a studio performance by Lady Lamb the Beekeeper, a New England musician whose star is rising. But first, the video game of autism. Last month, Vancouver hosted the Hacking Health Weekend Hackathon. That's a forum for collaboration between technology experts and health officials from across Canada. There, a team presented a game simulation designed to increase understanding and empathy toward those afflicted with autism. The first-person indie game is called AudiSim and uses 3D graphics to simulate the difficulties of sensory overload. Here's just a sample.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, and Z.
Tylan Kay is one of the developers behind the thought-provoking game and joins us now with more. Tylan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia.
Walk us through this game. What does the player see and hear?
Basically, the players find themselves in a busy playground and they assume the role of a child with autism. They have to navigate through this playground trying to find something to play with. But kids being kids, they are very loud, and soon you find out that can be a significant overload for your hypersensitive senses. And that overload is represented visually as distortion and blur, and as well as audio distortion as well.
Has this ever been attempted before, Thailand, simulating what it's like to be inside of the head of an autistic person?
It has, in different formats. I think there's an art installation in Netherlands where you basically enter this giant metal cage that is in the shape of a human head, and there are many screens and speakers all glaring at you. But of course, it's not very practical in terms of being able to experience it. You know, not everybody has the budget to have a field trip to Netherlands. In addition to that, of course, there's the documentary Inside Autism, which was the inspiration for this game, which documents the personal experiences of a person with autism going through Walmart. Well, it's a larger documentary, but that one part is about going through a mall, and the sensory overload there is so much that they have to flee the scene. But in terms of being able to experience it from a first-person view, I'm not aware of any other attempt.
How did you, Tylan, come to understand, as a person without autism, what the experience was like? How did you translate that into this game?
The technology part was actually not that hard. I also have people in my life who have their invisible disabilities getting in the way of them integrating with social life. It was interesting in that regard how something seemingly normal can pose a significant barrier, an inclusion challenge for somebody with a certain disability. So that was the main drive. Aside from that, the technology part was basically just taking what I saw in that documentary and just applying it to a 3D world.
Have you tested this out on any of your friends with autism? Do you know how close you came to replicating the experience?
We got a lot of feedback online. We reached about more than 90,000 people in the span of a month. The feedback has been very positive in that regard. But I have to say, autism is a very wide spectrum. So that one experience that we put on the screen is not representative of the entire spectrum. That said, many people came out and said, thank you for giving me a way to express what it is like for me. This is exactly what I go through. In some other cases, people said, okay, this is not exactly what I go through, but it does a good job of getting the point across. And for that, we support it.
Well, I'm wondering about that negative reaction. Anytime we've done anything on this program about autism, we find it's a very hot button issue. A lot of people respond.
Yeah.
A lot of people are very on guard about how things are portrayed. I wondered if anyone is criticizing you for capitalizing on the difference or highlighting the difference.
There have been criticisms, and we found that most of the criticisms were actually around the issue of having somebody with autism on the team and having their feedback. Due to the nature of the event, it was a weekend event, we couldn't arrange for somebody with autism to be on the team. After we received those criticisms, I personally made it my mission to engage people who voiced their concerns and actually gathered all the feedback from them personally. It seemed that their main concern was not necessarily the accuracy or portrayal of the condition, but more about being included in that process of producing something. And going forward, we will make sure that they are included.
What is the ultimate goal going forward? Are you going to try and sell this to consumers or maybe therapists or educators?
No, our goal is to keep this not-for-profit strictly available to all communities free of charge. But of course, it needs additional work to get to that point, to be a serious resource. For instance, you might have noticed there's no animation, there's no artificial intelligence.
Right.
The environment is just a playground. So we want to keep adding to that, basically make it a more immersive experience that is more representative of the general spectrum.
Are you funded for that, or is this all on your dime?
All on our dime. We are a team of three. We have our own limited resources. But we are looking for organizations and people who share our goal and values around raising awareness around this issue. And we are hoping to collaborate with them.
Tylan Kay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tylan Kay, team leader and developer behind AutoSim. That's a game in development that simulates the sensory experience of people with autism. You can find more on the project, including a video sample of the game, at wordofmouthradio.org. The existence of planets outside our solar system was first confirmed in 1992. Since then, hundreds of extrasolar planets have been identified. NASA's Kepler mission has detected more than 18,000 potential planets, some inside the so-called Goldilocks zone or habitable range. Now the American Museum of Natural History is breaking new ground in the observation of far-distant planets using high-tech spectroscopy navigation software. On the line with more to talk about what's being called Project 1640 is Ben Oppenheimer, associate curator at the American Museum of Natural History. He's also professor of astrophysics. Ben, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Greetings.
So what is Project 1640?
Project 1640 is something we've been working on for about 10 years. A large part of it is developing new technology so that we can routinely see planets orbiting nearby stars, but more importantly, capture their spectra. And that is a critical measurement that we do in astronomy. It's sort of how we find out everything about the objects we're looking at.
So this technology using spectroscopy, what can it detect or reveal that other observation methods cannot?
So what it basically does is you're measuring the brightness of an object at different colors, different wavelengths of light. And that's a very critical thing to do because every molecule absorbs light at very well-defined and known wavelengths of light. So if, for example, something like ammonia is present in the object that you're looking at, it will absorb specific wavelengths of light, and you'll see that signature in the spectrum. So basically what we're able to do is start to measure the chemical compositions of these distant planets.
So it's not so much like taking a photograph, it's creating a portrait based on its composition?
Yeah, but we do also take images. So what Project 1640 does is it takes images simultaneously at 30 different wavelengths of light, or colors, if you will, and then we can look at a particular object in the image and see how it changes from color to color. If it gets dimmer at one place and brighter at another, that will be indicative of a particular molecule, such as methane, carbon dioxide, or ammonia.
Okay, so what has spectroscopy revealed about the planets that you've actually observed, and anything groundbreaking here?
Well, that's the exciting thing. These four objects, which we've made these measurements for, are a little bit odd. They don't seem to correspond to any other known types of objects like stars or brown dwarfs, or even the planets of our own solar system. And I think that's the most exciting thing. The indications from finding all these planets over the past 20 years or so has been that there is a huge diversity in what they're like.
Mm-hmm.
And these four are neither similar to each other or any other ones we know of. So, you know, this notion of diverse population of planets is something that we've certainly confirmed here.
Mm. I wonder how precise a picture you can get, especially from this distance.
The resolution of our instrument is fairly low, but part of the problem here is that the star is so bright that the technology has to first remove the starlight and then allow you to see the planets. And so we're just getting started with this kind of remote reconnaissance business of these other solar systems. Ultimately, we want to get very high resolution so you can actually see atomic species and things like oxygen and stuff like that. Those would be signs of perhaps biological activity on a distant planet. I'm hoping in about 10 or 20 years we can come out with a paper like that.
How groundbreaking is this? I mean, I wonder if you and all your colleagues are just jumping up and down when you see this.
Well, yeah, we've been very excited about it. There are a number of other instruments similar to this coming online in the next year or so. For example, the Gemini Planet Imager, which we're also part of. And we've basically proven this technique. And now the goal is to use it on many other systems and see what else we find. We're going to survey roughly 200 stars in the next 3 years. You know, the planets have to be there for us to find something, but I'm hopeful.
Well, when looking upon these very, very, very distant planets, do you ever wonder if anyone's looking at us?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, one of the interesting things about the Kepler mission, which you mentioned earlier, is that it looks as though something like a quarter of sun-like stars may have an Earth analog around it. Now, that's very exciting. If you look at the volume of space that our powerful radio waves have emanated from, roughly 70 light years distance, there are probably three or four Earth-like planets that our radio transmissions have gone over.
I hope we get to speak with you about them again, Ben.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ben Oppenheimer, Associate Curator of the American Museum of Natural History and a Professor of Astrophysics. Ben's lead author of a paper on the first chemical fingerprints detected from planets outside of our solar system, orbiting a star 128 light years away from Earth. We posted links to more on the project on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. And coming up almost 60 years after Peyton Place exposed the hypocrisy of small-town life, we learn more about Grace Metalius, the rebellious New Hampshire housewife and author who could be Peyton Place's worst casualty. That's when Word of Mouth continues. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Nearly 60 years after Peyton Place was published, tourists still stop in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, to ask locals about its author, Grace Metalius. The novel's small-town secrets, sex, and hypocrisy shocked America and outraged the citizens of Gilmanton, where the unconventional Metalius lived with her family. It became one of the best-selling books ever, a hit movie, and TV's first primetime soap.
On a sunny morning almost 300 years ago, a young woman was drummed across this square to do public penance in the pillory. Afterwards, they shaved her head and sent her out of town forever. But like every girl in today's Peyton Place, Betty Anderson has heard this story many times. But knowing it didn't stop her from giving her love.
The show ran from 1964 to 1969, making Peyton Place synonymous with provincial meanness and its author an unlikely and reviled trailblazer. Writer George Kelly came across some persistent Metalius myths while writing about the novel for New Hampshire Magazine. His article, 50 Shades of Grace, The Impact of Peyton Place on New Hampshire 60 Years Later, is now online. George, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Virginia. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. And now, I grew up in New Hampshire hearing that Grace Metalius used to go grocery shopping in a mink coat and only a mink coat. True?
Probably a myth. There are lots of them, and they're floating around Gilmanton and all over New Hampshire, which I discovered. There are many people who really do not understand much about her at all. They've only heard things.
Well, I guess a lot of people seem to regard her as an eccentric. That's what comes across in your article. Or maybe even worse, you know, an outsider. And your article gives us a much more nuanced picture. I'd love you to fill out that portrait a little bit of this Manchester girl who grew up to scandalize a nation.
Well, Grace was born in 1924 in Manchester. And Manchester was dominated by the Amaskeag Mills, which were booming at the time. And it was also sectioned off pretty well. The west side of Manchester was Franco-American, French-Canadian. Then on the other side of the river, there were Greeks and Slavs and the Irish and other people. And then in the exclusive North End, there were the Yankees, and the Yankees owned the mills. And she grew up with a mom who had dreams of upward mobility. Her mother wanted her daughter to sort of break a glass ceiling if she could. And her mother had pretensions. She refused to be considered Franco-American, and she traced her lineage back to Paris, France, which was not true.
So the young Grace, I guess, had a little bit of this pretension. I see that she adopted the name in high school, Grace Marie-Antoinette Jeanne d'Arc de Repentigny.
Right.
A little pretentious herself. She did get married against her mother's wishes and wasn't such a good housewife, a kind of cavalier about her duties.
Actually, when her book finally sold, some people from the publishing house came up to interview her. And when they came into her house, which was called It'll Do, and she lived in Gilmanton, it was pretty much of a shack. There was garbage all over the floor. It was just in terrible shape. And then supposedly she reached for what she thought was a Brillo pad, and she picked up a dead rat instead. So her housekeeping abilities were non-existent. However, there was a little nook in the house that was squeaky clean with a desk, a chair, and a typewriter. And that's where she wrote Peyton Place.
She always insisted that the book was not autobiographical, sometimes quite vehemently so, and that Peyton Place itself was a composite of towns and not about Gilmanton, yet her fellow citizens really did shun her. Now, what does this say about the pettiness of Place that a town would assume that it's about them?
Well, the town actually has a point, because many of the characters in Peyton Place were thinly, very thinly veiled, including, for instance, the man who comes to be the principal is a Greek named Macris, who actually was a teacher in the Gilmanton Corner School. She forged his name on a release, and he sued her for $60,000 and won. The few people I could catch up with in Gilmanton who actually knew Grace were very upset by the fact that she really was talking about people they knew, and they are still unhappy about it.
Why was she so adamant about it not being autobiographical? In fact, if you could tell us a story, she was interviewed by Mike Wallace on
television. Yes, she went on. She was painfully shy and didn't want to conduct any interviews. She hated book tours. She was pretty much a private person that way. And she got very nervous, actually, and this is, remember, in the 1950s, and ripped her girdle somehow. And a young woman there helped her out. Her name was Jacqueline Suzanne, who later, of course, wrote Valley of the Dolls.
Right.
And when she had been promised that she wouldn't be asked if the novel was autobiographical by Mike Wallace, and Mike Wallace's first question was, is Peyton Place autobiographical? Well, she had learned that his name was Myron. And so she began to call him Myron, and then she brought up his three marriages. So she fought back during that interview.
Well, I mean, she sounds like quite a rebel. And I couldn't help but think about The Feminine Mystique, which was published almost a decade later, exposing similar secrets and desires in the lives of women and what they were up against. Now, did Grace Metalius take this upon herself to expose the hypocrisy, not just of small-town life, but of the Mike Wallaces? I mean, was she railing against the way things were?
Well, I think that she couldn't identify the feminine mystique. She was the wife of the school principal at the Gilmanton Corner School, and she refused to play Mrs. Schoolteacher. That's a quote from her. I think what she was exposing, or what she was attempting to expose, and I think she did it rather well, was the hypocrisy in the small towns. This book really is about three women who are victims: the mother, Constance McKenzie, and her daughter, Allison McKenzie, who is... That would be the question, is it autobiographical, right? Because she wants to be a writer. Mm-hmm. And also Selena Cross. It's about the haves and have-nots. The have-nots are the shack people. There is a fictitious mill there, which patterns itself after the Amaskeag Mills, although there is no mill in Gilmanton. And she exposed the underbelly of small-town life. She basically said that small towns are not Currier Knives. And at the end of her life, there was a treasure trove of letters found that people had written her from all over the United States saying that Peyton Place was their town. She had actually written about every small town in America.
Obviously touched a nerve. Mm. We're talking about Peyton Place and its lasting legacy with New Hampshire magazine writer George Kelly. Well, let's talk a little bit about her later life, which was pretty tragic. She died before she was even 40.
Yes, 37.
Her cemetery plot, she bought all around her a plot for herself so it wouldn't be anywhere near the townspeople that she lived with.
I visited there. That's in the Meeting House Cemetery. It's a very beautiful place at the height of the land in Gilmanton. And that's one of the myths, is that the townspeople didn't want her buried near them, so they put her off by herself. And actually, the opposite is true. She bought six lots to be away from them. People have put coins on top of the grave, and I was curious about that. The coins are placed there for debt unpaid and also to wish the person a good afterlife.
Huh.
It's an old, old sort of a practice that I had no idea about, but the few times I was there, there were quite a bit of change there. Mm-hmm. So people visit, and someone takes care of the grave. There were flowers there. There are people who owe her a debt.
Well, it's interesting you say that because her marriage dissolved. She made a whole lot of money. This, you know, sold 10 million books or something like that.
Yeah.
Movie rights, television, blew through her money pretty quickly. Went through one relationship after another. Probably an alcoholic. George, what do you think? Who was the real victim of Peyton Place's cruelty here?
Well, I think her grandmother Royer had said to her, "Grace, be careful what you wish for. You just might get it." And what she wanted to be is a famous author. When she felt trapped as a housewife, she turned to her writing. She had always written, even as a young child. She used to write in the bathtub over a little stool that she put there, and she was constantly writing. She turned to that for help and solace and as an escape from the trap she was in. And I think that the fame was so huge. She had rock star status. I mean, they thought if they sold 3,000 copies of Peyton Place, they were doing all right. This was Kitty Messner of Messner Associates who published the book. She was the only female publisher, by the way, and she's the only person who took the book. And suddenly, even before it was published, it was on the New York Times bestseller list because her publicity agent came to interview Grace Metalius, and she simply said she hoped her husband wouldn't lose his job. And he took that and parlayed that into a big headline about 2 inches high in the Boston Herald that said, "Principal's Housewife book may cost him his job." Uh-huh. And from there, it just took off. Uh-huh. She was an overnight, overwhelming success, and she was painfully shy. And I don't think she handled it well. She also was surrounded by the usual sycophants and hangers-on, whom she misinterpreted as people who genuinely liked her. And they were just there for her money, which she was making, piles of, $250,000 for the movie rights alone, let alone the book. She was also a victim of her agent who stole money from her. And also the producer of the movie also bought the television rights, and she didn't realize it. And she got no money from the television rights. So she was a real victim of her own success.
Well, George Kelly, it's a fascinating story. I'm so glad you dug into it for us. Thank you.
You're entirely welcome.
George Kelly wrote the New Hampshire Magazine article, 50 Shades of Grace, The Impact of Peyton Place on New Hampshire 60 Years Later. We do have a link to the article and some excellent factoids that he came up with on Grace Metalius that are just fascinating. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Peyton Place may be New Hampshire's most salacious export, but not its most delicious. especially this time of year when a much tastier native product is flowing. It's Maple Weekend in New Hampshire. That means sugar houses all over the state are open to the public with boiling sap and sweet syrup to sample. Syrup producers around the state are hoping for a strong season, but as Sean Hurley reports, heavy snow still on the ground has some tappers keeping their engloved fingers crossed.
Paul Weeks would rather be in his sugar orchard, checking sap lines for leaks or adjusting the boil on his evaporator. But today's bitter chill has given him an unwanted break.
Sitting here in the cold waiting for the sap to run. We're not going to get any sap till next week sometime, for lucky. It's supposed to be cold right through Monday, Tuesday.
Weeks waits for the sap in his sugar house in West Campton with his friend and fellow maple syrup maker, Bill Cheney.
What, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday? Yeah, 5 days in a row of pretty good sap runs.
Yeah.
So it's starting out like a regular season, light syrup, turning to medium.
Even though the weather has been promising, the ghost of last year presides.
You know, I think everybody this year is gun-shy after what happened last year when we had 70-degree weather in the middle of March.
Season ended about this time last year.
In Rumney, last year's heat wave still makes Maggie Brock shiver.
Last year was awful. It went for 8 or 9 days, and then we had that 5 days of 80 degrees, and that just killed it. Everybody else was loving the warm weather, and we were like, no. I was the only one that was depressed about the 80 degrees in March, you know. People were wondering, what's wrong with her?
Brock and her son, Nate, run a sugar house on Stinson Mountain.
And this building always heaves. My dad said he built this whole thing, and I think every cut he made was with a chainsaw. I don't think he is. So it's, you know, it's kind of seen better days.
The stovepipe and tea-stained wood are deceptive. Like a DeLorean in an abandoned barn, the old crooked shack hides a gleamingly modern machine.
Oh, a lot of it's science, and a lot of it is intuition. It's both, you know. It's sometimes when you're running around up here, it's like you're running a submarine, constantly checking temperatures, pressures, switching valves, draining tanks, you know, trying to keep the whole thing running as smoothly as possible.
There's only one thing that happens throughout the entire syrup-making process. Water is removed. To that end, the introduction of the reverse osmosis machine in 1971, which mechanically separates pure water from sap, has been revolutionary. In his sugar house in Woodstock, Jim Fadden says the RO, as everyone calls it, makes him 4 times more productive than his father.
My father comes around and sees this when I'm doing it. He thinks I'm cheating because we're not working hard enough.
Like a lot of the syrup makers, Fadden is part scientist, part fortune teller. He reaches for a hydrometer as readily as an old wives' tale.
And I like a nice blue sky. Wind from the west, sap runs the best. Wind from the east, sap runs the least. Old proverb.
Does that have any?
Certainly does. You get an east or a north wind, and the trees will stop dripping. I have no idea why, but it's just one of those funny things. West wind, nice blue sky, low barometric pressure, sap runs to beat the band.
Fadden's great-great-grandfather founded the family sugar orchard in the early 1800s. His grandfather opened Fadden's General Store in 1896.
I don't know, I think maybe maple sugarin's like an addiction.
Or worse, as Paul Weeks and Bill Cheney describe it.
It's a disease.
What's the bad part of the disease?
You just want to keep expanding.
Yeah.
A little isn't enough. You got to keep going, keep going, keep going, get bigger, and yeah, that seems to be the way.
A little like fishing, a little like panning for gold. At $32 to $35 a gallon and $1,800 or so a barrel, maple syrup is 13 times the price of crude oil. With that much at stake for Nate and Maggie Brock's, maple season creates a kind of fever.
You're just waking up every morning, you're like, all right, what's the weather doing today? Right, when do I have to be up there? Is it sunny here? What's the temperature at my house? If the temperature's 34 at my house, it's probably about 36 maybe up there if it's been in the sun. I'm like, you know, you get kind of anxious. And
you never know what Mother Nature's going to throw at you. You know, you could have a great season. You could go to the middle of April, or you could be done next week. You know, you just, everyone says, well, how's What do you think sugaring's going to be? And I say, I'll tell you May 1st. No clue.
It's a Rube Goldberg device, how the sun leans into the wind and warms the land, that squeezes the trees, that leak the sap, that trickles into the tanks, that bubbles and boils and thickens into a golden amber that you drizzle onto your pancakes one Sunday morning. It starts with the sun and the cold and ends with a smile or a sigh or just closed eyes. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
You can see photos of the syrup producers Sean visited and find a list of sugar houses to visit this weekend at wordofmouthradio.org. The Eiffel Tower has inspired countless t-shirts, souvenirs, and sentimental works of art. A new Kickstarter project aims to turn the iron and lattice landmark into a gigantic instrument. That's the dream of composer Joseph Bertolozzi, who proved that he can tackle projects on a mammoth scale when he wired and then played New York's Mid-Hudson River Bridge. Here's a sample of bridge music. Bertolozzi's Tower Music Project aims to unleash the voice of the Eiffel Tower to coincide with its 125th anniversary celebration in 2014. The project already has been cleared by the site's administrator. Now he's got to find a way to pay for it. Joseph Bertolozzi, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Nice to talk to you again.
Now, when we last spoke about bridge music, you had made a composition out of the cables and buttresses of a 3,000-foot span of the Mid-Hudson River Bridge. I guess that was just a warm-up?
Well, in a way, my original idea was to play the Eiffel Tower, but you know, I quickly realized that I don't speak French, and I thought, why don't I do it on something that's in this country where I live? So I did bridge music, and that was for the Henry Hudson Quadricentennial back in 2009, and then I used that finished product as a proof of concept when I approached the Eiffel Tower administration, so I'm back to the original idea now.
It's a very different structure, a different culture, and a different meaning. Obviously, the Eiffel Tower has a very deep place in a lot of people's hearts. How will tower music be different?
When I hear the sounds, I really can't answer that exactly. When I hear the sounds, I'll be able to then determine what kind of music that I'll be writing. It'll be the same in the sense that you'll have a composer, myself, who'll be writing fixed musical compositions for this particular set of stairs and handrails and spindles and things like that. So that's what's unique about it.
I'm curious about how you approach something so huge. I mean, what's the process in your mind?
Well, first of all, you have to get permission. And, you know, I wrote to the mayor of Paris many, many times and finally got an answer. And I went and pitched this to the administration. But how do you approach the structure to break it down? That's basically it. You know, you take it all in one glance, and then you start looking at it, and you see, oh, well, here's a rail, here's a spindle, here's a retaining wall, here's a gusset, and you just break it down into small pieces.
Well, it seems to me that whenever I've been to Paris, things feel differently. Do they sound differently there, too?
I maybe with a French accent, I don't know. I've got my eye on the prize, so everything else is sort of blocked out.
Bonne chance, Joseph Bertolozzi. Good
Merci.
Luck to you.
Merci.
Joseph Bertolozzi's organist and composer of bridge music and now pursuing his dream to make the Eiffel Tower sing. You'll find a link to his Kickstarter project, Tower Music, at wordofmouthradio.org or on our Facebook page or on Twitter. Now, you can stay with us for music on a much smaller, though quite emotionally powerful scale. Lady Lamb the Beekeeper performs a few songs when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
I cannot think of that song with this music on, and I never want to go back to Arkansas.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're listening to the song Regarding Ascending the Stairs by Lady Lamb the Beekeeper from her debut studio album, Ripely Pine.
I'm your apple.
The moniker Lady Lamb the Beekeeper came to Mainer Ali Spaltrow in a dream and has since been popping up on marquees up and down the East Coast, not to mention online, where we read reviews of her captivating, almost spellbinding live performances and steady output of original, idiosyncratic music that we're calling a mix between Feist and Nirvana. Ripely Pine is her first studio album and has already been featured by Time Magazine and NPR, setting Lady Lamb well on her way to becoming a national name. She's here to play some songs live for us and to talk with us a little. So, Ali, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Now, musicians don't usually like it when we say cross of this person and, you know, it's like the Beatles had brunch with the Beach Boys and then, you know, had a date afterwards with Patti Smith. What do you think? Feist and Nirvana?
I love that. I think it's fascinating, and I'm very flattered by that comparison for sure.
We know that Bon Iver had his cabin in the woods and Kanye West apparently rapped, you know, with his jaws wired shut. Your origin lore begins in the basement of a video store in Maine. Can you tell us a little bit about it? Is that a true story?
It's a true story. I come from Brunswick, Maine. I worked for 4 years at an independent DVD rental store called Barton Gregg's in my hometown right on the main street. Instead of going to college, I accidentally started playing music there and became so invested that I just ended up staying there for 4 years. And I really loved working there. I love film. And it happened to be in a basement, so I was able to write songs and record and be loud after hours. I worked the closing shift, and I would pull out my gear from behind a wall and just make music all night.
Well, the name of the band came to you in your sleep. Do you get a lot of your ideas from dreams?
I do. A lot of the material on this record actually is directly inspired by dreams. I tend to write after a dream when I wake up. If it really got to me, I'll write it down pretty immediately. And then within those key words come the lyrics.
Well, let's hear from the new record, Ripely Pine. This song is called The Nothing, Part 2. And this is Lady Lamb the Beekeeper playing live for us in Studio D.
Choose to use your heart, if even towards the harshest fate that it may be swallowed, a masticated, mistaken thing, that you may ripely pine in the mammoth nothing of the night, left to your own devices and to exhaust it to know. They've had it up to here with you and first.
That's the Nothing Part 2. Lady Lamb, the beekeeper, played that live for us in Studio D here at New Hampshire Public Radio. Lady Lamb, the beekeeper, is the band name of Ollie Spaltro, and she's with us talking a little bit about her new record, which is called Ripely Pine. What does it mean to ripely pine?
To me, it means to long for something with a pulpy heart. Really, that's where that comes from. And it's directly out of a lyric from that song, The Nothing Part 2,
yeah,
on the album.
I noticed that. Well, I know you were around 18 or 19 years old when you wrote most of the songs on this record. Where were you internally at that time?
You know, I was exactly where I think every 18-year-old kid is at. I just found a way to express it. You know, at that age, you're so dramatic and everything is just this massive issue and heartbreak is everywhere and everything's a sign, and I just found a way to put it into words what I think we all feel when we're that age, and that's where the songs came from.
Hearing them live, watching you perform them in the studio, I was thinking about how sort of cinematic some of them are, and I just wonder, I mean, you must have been working all day watching DVDs, watching great films, and then making music. Do you think that came across?
Life. Absolutely. That was my life was music and film, and they definitely became interspersed.
Which is fascinating because so many reviewers who write about your live performances, you know, one of them says, it was one of those situations where you could have heard a pin drop, that everybody was so intensely focused on you and you had your eyes closed. Is this cinematic image, are these playing in the back of your eyelids when it's happening?
They are. To this day, these songs certainly have a visual for me, and I'm there in the movie.
Let's hear more from the new record. This is the song Between Two Trees. This is Lady Lamb, the beekeeper, recorded live from Studio D here at New Hampshire Public Radio.
A pillow till it makes you tired, bummed out my whole pack, and I gave my fire all my fire. Emptied my pockets, these empty pockets, emptied my pockets, and I waited for your call. Laid on the pavement, down on the pavement, laid on the pavement with my ear against the wall. Stood on the mountain, up on the mountain, stood on the mountain, and I called your name. I am no savior, I am no savior, I am no savior. Just your dog, and I'm all tied up. See how I'm tied up. My wrists are bound. I am the boat on your dock. I'm just the boat on your dock.
That's a song, Between Two Trees. I hear that lyric and you say, my wrists are bound. I am the boat on your dock. That's such a main image.
It sure is.
Right? Stuck.
Yeah.
Just stuck there. And I wonder, now you live in Brooklyn, no longer in Maine. Has that changed your approach to songs? I mean, your whole field of vision must be so different.
It, interestingly for me, has changed the way that I sing in terms of not having a practice space now in Brooklyn at the moment. So finding clever ways to write music and not make too much noise. So whereas in Maine I could be really loud in the basement with an electric guitar, now I'm sitting on my bed with an acoustic guitar, which has opened up. I found my range, and I've noticed that I can sing different ways I didn't know that I could, which has been a great thing to learn.
I will bury you between two trees. I will bury you with me.
You do get to a lot of places. I mean, emotionally, there's quite a range. There's a rawness, there's screaming. Sometimes there's maniacal kind of laughing in the songs, almost a kind of crying. You really put yourself out there emotionally. Do you think that's something that you might regret in a few years' time?
No. Because I feel really that the record and the music I make is coming from such an earnest place, and that's so important to me. And that's the way that I know how to make art. And so I think I'll continue to just be myself and be raw and honest as much as I can.
In all of your press photos, you look like you're having fun. You're surrounded by different flavors of pie, eating them with your hands. In your music video for The Nothing Part 2, which we heard earlier, you kidnap a bunch of people and force them to eat pie. So what is this fascination with pie?
I personally love pie. It's one of my favorite things. And on a rainy day, I like to just go get a slice of pie. And also, the album title reminds me of pie, Ripely Pine. And, you know, it reminds me of pie and of fruit and ripe fruit. And I love to eat. And I thought it would be fun to get messy and let them be part of the album visual.
Well, here, let's leave listeners with the deep, dark color of a nicely cooked blueberry pie. This is the song Aubergine, performed by Ali Spaltro, Lady Lamb, the beekeeper. Ali, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, I bled blue blood from my back. Last night I was alone. Oh, aubergine sheets on my bed now. Oh, no. And your blue eyes. Just like an atlas in those sockets. Yeah, your blue eyes cry map water when you're sorry, oh, so sorry. Oh, no. Ooh.
Ali Spaltro is Lady Lamb the Beekeeper. Her debut studio album is called Ripely Pine. You can find more on where Ali is touring and watch video of her live performance here in NHBR Studio D on our Facebook page or at wordofmouthradio.org. And thanks so much for spending some time with us today. If you did miss any of the program, or if you'd like to pass a segment along to a friend, click on over to wordofmouthradio.org. That's where we have a pretty jam-packed archive of conversations and topics and easy icons to post them on Facebook or Twitter or send them to your friends. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoy.
With plenty of help from our awesome interns,
Ali Kosmikas
and Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast
and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.
Absence makes my heart grow hollow. Absence makes my heart grow hollow. Make me into an egg without yolk. You make me into an egg without yolk. I was unborn when I was younger. I was unborn when I was younger. But I was rebuilt when you spoke. I awoke when you spoke. You said there's always a reason for leaving. There's always a reason to stay. I know exactly why I'm leaving. I just can't stay, and I say I'll give you my whole summer. You had nothing to do with me. You're to blame for my being this way. Hey, 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 hey. You